This is a live recording from the IANS North American Conference, July 13th through 15th, the year 2000, in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Mission in the New Millennium. This is tape number F1, Update, Less Than Positive Near-Death Experiences, with Dr. Barbara Romer.
Dr. Romer specializes in internal medicine. She's a busy lady. She has so many hats, I can't even count them all. Since 1973, she's been the facilitator, and she was the first the person that started the South Florida IANS program. That group has been very, very active. Can you hear me? At what year? 93? It was 93. No? Okay. They're going to celebrate their fifth anniversary. Bad cheat sheet here. She's the author of Blessings in Disguise, Another Side of the Near-Death Experience. It's a Llewellyn book, and she will be having a book signing in the bookstore after this, her talk. The South Florida IANS group has been on several major network events, then A&E special on Beyond Death, and also CBS's 48 Hours. Not only is she a wonderful speaker, she's also a mom, and she is, I hope you all get a chance to meet and greet her. Let's give her a warm welcome, Dr. Barbara Romer. Uh-oh. Can you hear me well? All right. Want to sit down, folks? Okay. Albert Einstein said, "Whatever there is of God and good God in the universe, he must work itself out and express himself through us. We cannot stand aside." I believe that that is why we're all here. Today we'll be discussing an update on the frightening or less than positive experiences. And I'll also tell you a little bit about how this first book, Blessing in Disguise, came to be and why it came to be. Those of you who have heard me speak before, whether at the last three IANS conferences or elsewhere, know that I really never say word one about me or my spiritual journey. I just have never talked about myself. I felt very, very fortunate, very blessed when the publisher accepted my manuscript for publication. They recognized that there was very little written about these frightening experiences, and they knew that the need was there. But they had a very unusual comment to make. They said that I was conspicuously absent from the pages of the manuscript. Dr. Samuel Johnson said years ago, "We are inclined to believe those whom we do not know because they have never deceived us." Well, the publisher did not agree to that statement, and now neither do I. It was difficult to put myself at all into the book, but I did. I'd always defined myself, for as long as I can remember, sort of as the ultimate caregiver. I was the only girl in my medical school class for all 4 years. I began medical school a lot of years ago when it was really very difficult for a female to get into medical school. And honestly, several of my professors, and this was stated, hoped that I would fail. They did not want women in medicine. We were always in a very high anxiety state, always studying, always competing. And we were always intellectually fertile. But the trade-off was that we became very spiritually barren. As far as death was concerned, we dealt with death in a very clinical, purely physiologic, purely biologic, almost cold, not almost, cold way. I distinctly remember when a patient was ready to go into spirit, we would have the nurses take the family, get them coffee, put them into a waiting room so that they would not be there when their loved one finally did expire. I heard my very first account of a near-death experience, a profound near-death experience, when I was doing my residency in internal medicine. It was in 1970 or 1971, and I was at that time at the Manhattan VA hospital. And his name was Mr. Sylvester. He was a World War II vet. I will never forget this. I was the admitting physician for the weekend. Mr. Sylvester had had a heart attack, was brought to the VA hospital. I was examining him, and right there, right in front of me, he coded. He stopped breathing, his heart stopped, and he was clinically dead. Now, in those days, it was highly unusual to successfully resuscitate someone from a cardiac and pulmonary arrest. It was rare, rare. But by the grace of God, there just happened to be a cardiology resident and a vascular surgical resident sort of keeping me company, schmoozing with me that weekend. And honestly, for the practice of it, they cracked open his chest, literally opened his chest and did an open heart massage, and of course did resuscitate him. The next morning, we were making rounds at 6:30 in the morning, and one of my medical students was presenting this case. And of course then questions are asked of the interns, of the medical student by the interns and the residents. Throughout this, that patient was giving me the most hateful looks you could possibly imagine, dagger sharp throughout. And that squeezed my heart all day long. Around 7:30 that night, when I was finally going off call, I went back to the coronary care unit to find out why he was looking at me so hatefully. He told me that he was angry at being back, angry at being jerked back from that blissful realm, and he did tell me his whole wonderful, wonderful experience. He also told me that when he initially went out of his body, he did hang around and he was watching the cardiology resident and the vascular surgical resident and the blood, and he heard one of the medical students say to them, "You better keep going until you got him back or the Frau will be on the warpath." I didn't know until then that the medical students and the interns called me Frau Rommel. So that is the truth. So there was no doubt that I believed his story. I even discussed it with my father, who was a very spiritual man. But I then entombed his account into the catacombs of my mind, and it never came forward until a few years ago when I had to come up with the idea of a true and unusual speech for Toastmasters. I did my first formal interview with a near-death experiencer on December 12th of 1994. It was actually with one of my own medical patients. Now, I've always been a really loving doc and in private practice, and despite even now with HMOs, I don't mill patients through. I spend a lot of time with my patients, so I don't see a lot of patients every day. I spend time with them. I talk to them. We've grown up together. So can you imagine how unbelievably humbling it was for me to find out that a lot of my patients, even ones I had resuscitated, had had a near-death experience, but never told me, because they thought that I would not be able to receive it. I thought that I was projecting the love that I really felt, the interconnectedness, the acceptance, the forgiveness, the everything. Well, I might have thought I was projecting it, but it wasn't being received. And so I wasn't getting that information until, obviously, I was changing. It's really interesting how this first book came to be about the frightening experiences. Actually, I was in the midst of writing one about what I lovingly call the glitzy experiences, and I was in the fourth chapter. But what happened was our president, Diane Corcoran, I'm not sure if she even remembers this or knows this, she gave me a call, and we were, of course, talking about near-death experiences, and somehow we got on the discussion of the distressing ones. And I guess it seemed to her that I had more of these than any other researcher. So she asked me to put in a proposal to speak at the San Antonio conference. I counted to 10 silently, and I dared myself to say yes, because that was just a few years ago, but it's when I was going to Toastmasters because I had such overwhelming fear of speaking to more than two or three people at a time that was going to be the first big conference that I'd ever spoken at. As a matter of fact, I was not able to be chief resident as I was to be because I refused to do what we lovingly called liver rounds because my subspecialty was GI, and I wouldn't hold the internal medicine conference. So obviously I've been able to change that. So what happened was I agreed to speak at that conference, and I thought, I'm smart, let me skip ahead in the book I'm writing. I'll write that chapter that's going to be on the frightening ones, take out an hour presentation, then go back to where I was writing the book on the glitzy ones. Well, I go out about once a month with two girlfriends of mine, and they're the ones who went with me to Delphi, a very spiritual place where we took all of the mediumship and spiritual healing courses, and we sort of take turns in saying what's been happening to us spiritually. And I was telling them about this, that I'm going to be speaking at the Texas conference, and that I was in the midst of writing that chapter on the frightening ones, and I said, but it's ridiculous, it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, it's like a book and I'm not even done. And they looked at me and I looked at them, and we realized this is the first book, because that's where the need was. It was no accident. As far as why I began researching the near-death experiences in the first place, back in 1994, I told myself simplistically that I was doing it because I didn't want my patients to fear death. Now, surely, not just me, but every other physician, nurse, everyone in any medical profession has to realize really soon on in their training that most people have such fear of death that their joy of living is diminished. That fear is fear of the unknown, and that fear controls people. If you fear death, you fear life. And it seemed to me, it was really obvious, that those few people who didn't have that fear were the ones who either were already on a spiritual path, or the ones like Kathy, who had had a near-death experience because they had already died and had been resuscitated. Now, when anyone asked me why I was writing the book, especially when the media asked me if this book was about me, about an experience I had had, I always answered the same thing. Absolutely not. It's not about me. It's about them. I'm merely a reporter. I report other people's near-death experiences. It's not about me. It's about them. Well, several months ago, I was speaking in San Francisco, and I was asked just exactly that question. And I was answering it just exactly that way. But this time, it was different. This time, and for the first time, I heard what I was saying, and a light bulb went off. And I realized it is about me. And it is about you. It's about every one of us. Because yes, we are many, but we are one. And so, all of our journeys matter. It is about all of us. Einstein said, and obviously I love Einstein, that the tragedy of human nature is the illusion of separation. We are not separate. And when one either has a near-death experience or vicariously experiences one of these events, then we all expand. Because when one person expands his consciousness, we all expand our consciousness and do raise the vibratory frequency of this planet as a whole. So I initially thought my reason for doing the book was to, let us say, convince people that they shouldn't fear death because we do not die. That's a for sure. Yes, of course, this physical body dies, but our soul, our spirit, our life force, our higher consciousness, our higher being, whatever you wish to call it, does continue on and does have an existence separate and apart from this physical body. And I personally have astounding confirmation of that. But that's for another time. But I've come to realize that my message, my purpose, my raison d'etre, isn't to convince people that we don't die, but to show them that we do absolutely continue to live, and that that living is a wonderful soul journey with a purpose. And I have also come to realize that every single one of us is just exactly where we're supposed to be, both physically and spiritually, at this moment in time, to learn the lessons that we're here to learn. And you know, when we all realize that everyone is just exactly where we're supposed to be, then that can help to alleviate some of the hurt, disappointment, anger that we may feel toward ourselves and toward others because of, let us say, less than positive behavior or disappointing decisions. In good conscience, I have to tell you that I feel great knowing that I don't really now have to convince anyone of anything. Because our souls do already know these truths. And I'm very proud to share what I've come to learn, even though it's difficult to share anything personal, because of how it really has profoundly and positively changed my life on a soul level. And now on to what we're supposed to talk about, which is the less than positive or frightening experiences. As you may recall, back in 1992, Dr. Bruce Grayson and Nancy Evans Bush first described three types of what they call distressing near-death experiences. In the first type, it's where it's described just like one of the glitzy ones, but the person perceives it with absolute terror. In the type two, it's where a person finds himself or herself in a black, eternal, formless void, often feeling bound. And there have been mechanistic presences and shadowy presences described. And in the type three, that's where there's the horrible, true, graphic, hellish imagery. And in the type four that I feel exists, it's where it is specifically the life review that causes absolute terror. I have seen over and over and over again that these frightening experiences cause such soul growth, even often more so than with the glitzy ones, that they can't be called negative, they should not be called negative experiences. They are truly a blessing in disguise, i.e., that's why the title of my book. And please, I beg of you, don't automatically assume that if you hear of someone who had one of these hellish experiences, that it necessarily means that they're a mean person. That is absolutely not the case. I really believe, I really know, that every one of us, any one of us, could have one of these experiences if our attention needed to be brought to some previous choice that was erroneous at the time. I'm going to give you quick examples of each one of these types. In the type one, remember, that's where it's described just like one of the blissful ones, but the person perceives it with fear. This is experiencer's name is Anthony. He's an 80-year-old little Italian man, a real doll. He is from Fort Lauderdale. He had a massive heart attack, was brought to Holy Cross Hospital, which is my main hospital. And while he was in the cardiovascular intensive care unit, he had a cardiac arrest. He was obviously resuscitated rapidly. But because of the experience that he had, he was petrified. And he was supposed to have open heart surgery the next day for a coronary artery bypass quadruple. He was refusing to have the surgery. One of the male nurses, who is an extremely spiritual gentleman, wonderful, wonderful nurse, and of Native American background, called me to ask me if I could come and talk to the patient that night because he was refusing the surgery, but they didn't want to cancel it until I spoke with him. So obviously I got permission from his attending and from the surgeon, and I did go talk to him. This is what he said, and let me just say quickly that I say this every time. I will not paraphrase an experiencer. It is their experience. You need to hear them tell it. I have to give you direct quotes. Quote, I was lying here and felt this pain coming on, and then the first thing I know, I had no pain, and I passed out. I saw this big cave, and it was filled with white clouds, and I felt myself starting to fall down through that cave. I was reaching out to the sides, trying to grab something, and I couldn't. I shouted out for someone to help me. I said, I'm falling, and there's no one to help me. So I fell down, rather floated down, through there, and the next thing I knew, there were these two nice nurses, one on either side of me, saying, you're going to make it, we got you back, unquote. Now, Anthony had never heard, read, or seen on television anything about near-death experiences before. Never knew what it was. So he didn't know that had it gone on longer, the light would have been coming. He might have been greeted by his loving deceased wife, his deceased daughter, parents, and sister. Also, Anthony was brought up to programmed to assume that anything in a downward direction was toward hell. He thought he was going to hell. And third of all, and most important, and this is the way it is with every one of these type 1 experiencers, and especially with Italian gentlemen. I was married to a Sicilian for 25 years until he went into spirit. He was used to being in control of all situations in his life at all times. Well, in this situation, we're not in control. So he, of course, had terrible fear, and that's why he feared death even more than his usual and was refusing the surgery. When he understood all these things, of course he agreed to the surgery. Of course he did great, and he's continuing to do great. So that was the type one. In the type 2 experience, again, as Bruce Grayson and Nancy Evans Bush described, it's where there's the black eternal void where a person may feel bound. Now, this type 2 comprised 20% of all of my less than positive experiencers. 50% of them did call out to God to try and get out of the experience. And 54.5% of these type 2 people had self-induced their death, either intentionally or unintentionally. Obviously intentionally if they wanted to commit suicide. Unintentionally if they were doing self-destructive behavior like, you know, drug or alcohol abuse, driving terribly, and had by accident had an accidental overdose. Some of them did start out this way and then went into a really blissful experience. Frank is another Italian gentleman. He comes to South Florida IONS, and he's very supportive of South Florida IONS. He was, years ago, a very successful entertainer, musician, in Rome, California, and New York. He admitted that he came back from Rome. He was 30 years old, and he came back to, quote, the nightclub scene, unquote. He performed, and after his performance, he and a lady friend were drinking. He admitted that they were, quote, soused out on scotch, unquote. He drove. He was speeding. He lost control of the car. He hit a tree. His head went through the windshield, and he totally cracked the windshield, and he was thrown out of the car. The lady was killed in that car accident. When he was initially out of his body, he said he heard a policeman saying, "I wouldn't give you 10 cents for his life," unquote. And this is what he described he went through, quote, "Then suddenly I was in a dark place going up very, very fast. I kept ascending. I had great fear in that darkness. I knew I was coming from a bad place, drinks, drugs, and the entertainment field. I had a short life review. I saw myself as a child, and again in Rome. I cried out to Jesus, 'I'm not in a state of grace, Jesus.'" By the way, he was Catholic. "Let me live and I'll do it right." Then the dark, dark blackness became dark lavender, and then I felt a sudden, sublime serenity, a calmness that I've never felt before, not even in Rome. I felt he was there, and angels too. A definite spiritual presence," unquote. This experience absolutely not only made him reevaluate his whole life, but he changed his whole life, his whole lifestyle. He said, "I was being shown that I had to ship up or shape out, one or the other. In other words, get your act together. And I did just that. My life changed like night and day. I went from living in top hotels to one room in the village," that's in Manhattan, "where I was able to get involved in the University of the Streets. I totally changed my career. I've gotten back to my religion. I found a church where I feel comfortable. I used to be a wild man, and I fight all the time. I'm much calmer now. I don't fear death. I'm fearless because I know that if I ask, I will live again. I know there's a life after life. I know there is reincarnation." And by the way, he's a hypnotherapist now. "There's a Zen saying, 'Now that my house is burned down, I have a better view of the sky.'" And another saying I love by Charles Weston, he said, "We turn to God for help when our foundation is shaking, only to realize that it's God that's shaking it." Well, all of the type 3, the people who had the hellish experiences, would absolutely agree to both of those statements. The type 3, the hellish ones, comprised the largest percent of my study, 41.7%. But 46.7% of them did transform with time into one of the blissful ones. Now, this is amazing to me. 27.8% of the type 3 experiencers labeled themselves as agnostic or atheist, prior to the experience. 18% of this group also had self-induced their death intentionally or unintentionally. This lady's initials are RMG. She's of Native American background. A couple of months ago in May, I was on the Coast to Coast radio show, and the host was Ian Punnett. And many, many people called in and shared their experiences, and this is one of them. This is what she said. I'm an Orthodox deaconess for the Russian church in exile. My 4-year-old son died in Galveston. He was drowned. I went to Hawaii during my grieving period. My family couldn't console me. I was on Waikiki Beach late at night. I'd obtained some barbiturates on the street and some booze, and I decided I was going to kill myself. I washed the barbiturates down with the booze, stripped naked, and swam out. I got past the breakers and was in open ocean. All of a sudden, a spirit guide or guardian angel appeared and was with Gray Hawk, an American Indian. My son was beside him. My son said, "No, Mommy, it's not time for you to come home yet to be with us." And Gray Hawk showed me a desolate plain with nothing but skeletons. It went on for as far as the eye could see with like red lava going through it. I said, "Please, I can't live without my baby." And Gray Hawk shook his head and tears came down his cheek and he said to me, "No, you have got more to do in life." And my son Quincy said, "Mom, I love you, but it's not time for you to be with us. This is what will happen if you try again. You'll come to this place instead of the good place." And the next thing I knew, I was raised up out of the water, whooshed back onto the beach, and I was dry and had my clothes on. I swear on a stack of Bibles that that is exactly what happened, unquote. As Nietzsche said, that which doesn't kill us makes us stronger. Here's another type 3. Tyson is from Fort Lauderdale, another entertainer, and he was 21 years old when this happened. He had performed, then he was out drinking. He actually arrived home safely, drove himself home, and went to sleep, but he awakened and said that he felt really weird. Well, thank God he woke his wife up, and he had a convulsion. A seizure, a grand mal seizure. She called 911 and he was taken to the hospital. And this is what he said, quote, "In the hospital I started to pass out and then it was dark. Physicians were shoving tubes down my throat and my nose. That was it. Then I was out and they called a code blue. I'm just telling you what I was told. I was on life support by the time my family got there. And then it like went from reality to supernatural. It was extremely bizarre. I've only told my wife and you. Anyone else would probably think I was nuts. I was living a lifestyle that was very wild. I was doing a lot of things I shouldn't have been doing. I was going down the wrong path, hurting people, hurting myself. Anyway, there was this supernatural figure. It was like a devil to me. He was very scary. He was the devil. He was a demon. I had no idea I was in the hospital. All I knew was that I was chained to like a bed and I was being tortured. I could lift my head up far enough to see this big steel double door with a 3/4-inch gap underneath. I could see and feel heat and flames. It was so damned hot that I felt I was lying on coals. I'll be honest with you, I thought I was in hell. It was the most horrible thing you could ever imagine going through. Have you ever come up on a possum at night driving and your headlights hit his eyes and they glow like beams? Well, that's what that demon's eyes looked like. And his hair was extremely dark. He was wearing black, had really long fingernails, and he was extremely sweaty and agitated. And there was an even stronger force that was there, but I couldn't see a face, but it was talking to me. It was torturing me, too. It kept telling me, you're going to die. And it would say other vulgar things that I won't tell you. And I sensed monsters, hideous, horrible, and I could see their shadows and movements, but not any faces. I was raised Pentecostal. I was in what I grew up to expect hell to be like. I definitely felt judgment. I definitely felt I was there because I put myself there. I knew I was going to be chained right there to that bed forever. Nothing was ever going to change. I do believe that if I had passed away then, for good, then I might really have been there forever, unquote. This lifetime really is about choices. Every second of this lifetime involves a choice. And he knows, like we all have to know, that we're responsible for those choices. Aristotle said, wherever I go, there I am. We can't escape ourselves or our choices. Here's one more. This is RC from Colorado. He also called into that same Coast to Coast radio show. Great people called into that radio show, ones that we never would have heard. And he was in a head-on collision. Wasn't his fault. He was really hurt very badly and straight away was taken to surgery and was in surgery for 8.5 hours. So it was during that time that he had this experience. He said, quote, by the way, obviously, I recorded the radio show and I transcribed the tapes. Somewhere in the midst of that process, a voice came to me, called my name and said, you're busted up. Your body is in bad shape. You're probably not going to make it. Why don't you just curse God and die? That voice was just as real to me as your voice is now, just as audible. My response was, I will serve God. The very next moment, the voice spoke to me in a very authoritative fashion, called me by my Christian name, and said, come up here. When he said that, I began to move out of my body. And as I passed through the areas where I had damage, that pain ceased. I was very cognizant of that. And when I was out of my body completely, I had no pain whatsoever. I was immediately in the presence of an individual who was at the very least a head taller than myself. It was like if you go in the presence of a field officer, like a major, or colonel, or general, when they give an order, you follow it without question. I asked him, why am I here? He told me, I'm going to take you someplace and show you something. Ultimately, we wound up in a building that was like a large gymnasium, rectangular shaped without any bleachers or anything. There was a large set of black double doors on the other end, about 8 feet wide and probably 10 to 12 feet tall, just massive. He said, I want you to go to the door. I want you to put your ears to the door and listen. This was real, and it still bothers me to this day, and it's been 11 years. I went across the room and stopped about 2 feet short of the door. I could hear a roar that was indistinguishable. It was a very massive, very large sound. I kind of halfway turned to my right and said, I don't understand. He said, step forward and put your ear to the door. I did just that. I heard this massive sound. The more intent your listening becomes, you begin to separate, and you can understand what that sound is. What I heard was a virtual sea, an ocean of voices in such agony and anguish and torture. It was screaming and gnashing of the teeth, that kind of unimaginable sound coming from all these people. I said, what is that? His response was, those are all of the ones that are in a place where God's light does not go. The only thing they are suffering from is the absence of the presence of his love. Quickly, my response was, "Is that where I'm going?" He said, "No, I brought you here so that you would listen. I'm going to take you back. I want you to tell them that it is real." I said to him, "How long will that go on?" And this is the part that really made me shudder to this day. He said, "It has no end." Unquote. Now on to the type 4. The type 4 experience is where it's specifically the life review that causes the terror. This is the account from Mark, who lives in Indianapolis. And by the way, this experience will also fit into, I don't know whether you heard Dr. Raymond Moody here a couple of years ago, but he was discussing what he calls the empathic death experience. This would also fit that category. So this is Mark speaking. Quote, "A friend of mine went into coma the last week of 1979 and 5 days into 1980. He was still comatose in the hospital. I was home, and I was standing in the basement and got this really strange feeling. It was like everything started to come unglued. I knew I had to lay down quick. So I laid down, and as soon as my head hit the pillow, it's not like things went white or black. Things went red. All I could perceive was the color red. And I started going through this tunnel. Now, it's not a pleasant tunnel. It was a zigzag, like you were in a coal mine, back and forth, zigging and zagging. And on the walls of the tunnel, there was like a depiction of everything I had done that I had not repented of in my life. And I kept going through this tunnel, and at the end was not a light. It was like a stained glass window. What was depicted on the window was a raven with red eyes. And I thought, oh my God, I am going to hell. And I just called on the name of Christ. And when I did that, I was suddenly involved with a blue light. A beautiful, soft light surrounded me. As far as I knew, I was still going through that tunnel. It was a really shocking experience, and I was really panicking. I was out of my body. I could feel my soul breaking away. It was terrifying. And somebody put his hand on my chest, and I said, "Let go, let go." And the voice came back to me, and he said, "Why don't you open your eyes and see who it is?" And I knew at that point it was Christ. And I couldn't look him in the eye. And what happened was he pushed me, literally pushed me back into my body. When I woke up, about a half an hour later, I knew that Ralph, my friend, had died because I had shared that experience with him. Now, what I think happened was that because he was comatose and he had not been given the opportunity to repent of some things, that I shared that experience with him. These frightening experiences, I think that there is basically 4 reasons why a person might have that type instead of one of the blissful ones. First and foremost, a frightening experience will challenge the experiencer to stop, look back, and reevaluate every one of those choices of our lifetimes. Every action, every reaction, every thought, every word. And then make appropriate mid-course changes in direction. I firmly believe that we attract the experience that we need for our spiritual growth. Sophocles said, "The keenest sorrow is to recognize ourselves as the sole cause of all of our adversities." That's the first reason. The second reason for having a frightening experience: if a person's mindset immediately prior to the experience immediately prior to the heart attack, the accident, the surgery, whatever, if their mindset is less than loving, less than positive, or fear-based, then a frightening experience may ensue. Third, if someone is brought up with negative programming, brought up to expect hellfire and brimstone, then they will project that to the cosmos in a near-death situation, and that is what they may be given to experience. And fourth, a frightening experience may occur with the sole purpose of having that experiencer become a messenger, as we just saw. Sometimes the person is directed in so many words, like this gentleman was, and sometimes it's an implied direction. Now, unlike the other less than positive near-death experiencers, these experiencers who are directed are driven to talk about their experience. Most of the others, it's very difficult to get them to come forward to discuss it. So obviously, these frightening experiences, just like the wonderful ones, teach us the same things, what we were saying about choices and about why we're here this time around. We are here, obviously, to learn and to teach and in some way to make a positive difference. Every one of these experiencers has made an astounding difference because look how we're receiving what they're teaching us. And it is about love, and it is about forgiveness. In A Course for Miracles, it says, forgiveness is the only sane response. That's true. It is about love. Sophocles, obviously, I love these people. Sophocles said, one word frees us from all the weight and pain in the world, and that word is love. And Swami Bayondananda, this is going to be my last quote, said, I have good news and I have bad news. The bad news is that we have lost the key to the door behind which the secret of life has been. The good news is that door was never locked. And I thank you. Of course, I'd love answers even more. Would you come up for the tape? Thank you.
Hello. I'm Jenna Sanyor, and I've been studying mythology for many years, doctoral studies at Michigan. The descent of the spirit is often misinterpreted by Judeo-Christians as falling into hell. But if you look closely, not only at the Bible in the original Hebrew, where the word pit is also the Hebrew for womb, place of renewal. Okay, it's a pun. It means two things. You also have the Greco-Roman culture, where you have the descent of Proserpina into the underworld, often seen as a negative experience, but in fact it is not. And this also goes for Inanna's descent into the underworld, where she meets her sister Eriskigal. And even Christ's descent into hell, the harrowing of hell. Descent means going into the womb of the Blessed Mother. It's a feminine concept of God where you enter into a womb in order to be made new. Now, men often go down instead of up when they die, in my own experience talking to people over the years. Or women who are very woman-identified will go down instead of up. Women will go up, or if you're a male-identified man, you'll go up. Up is phallic, down is vaginal. It is, I know it's funny, but we have a mother and a father consciousness, a sort of a yin and a yang. And they're very positive, and when this happens, you have to ask very logical questions and say to yourself, why would there be such a tradition of descent as a way to the womb, to rebirth, if it was inherently evil? And it's not inherently evil to go down. It's inherently evil to be wicked. You see, otherwise the ocean floors would be wicked and the mountaintops would be holy. And that isn't true. Ocean floors aren't wicked. Do you know what I mean? So this sort of thing has to be brought back. The consciousness of the feminine aspect of the afterlife has to be brought back in a very male-identified or patriarchal culture. We've got to be pulling all that back and remembering the sacredness of the female direction. Okay? So that's my comment.
Thanks. Now I'm really going to think about that, and I'm going to look back on a lot of the accounts that I have, and that may be so. I had never realized that. The experiencers that I interview, I know really well. I've done interviews that lasted well over 8 hours, two sessions. So I'll be able to tell absolutely if they fit into what you're saying. That's fascinating. Yes, could you come up, please?
Thank you, Barbara. That was it's a very important book, and we need to know these things. I'm especially interested in suicide and the suicidal people who had the less than positive experiences. I think you said 50% were suicide, 54%, and 50% called out to God. And of those who called out to God, did the experience transform for them, or did they remain in that state? Because I've heard it both ways with people I've talked to who, you know, had suicidal NDEs.
Thanks. Very valid question. Every one of the experiencers who called out to God, either it did change into a blissful one, or it did, thank God, abort the experience straight away. But I have to make a really important point. You have to remember this. This is critical. Please do not think in any way, shape, or form that if someone attempts suicide, that necessarily mandates that they're going to have a frightening experience, because I better not have given that impression. That is absolutely not the case. I think that with all of these experiences, whether really joyful or a frightening one, that we get just exactly what we need and what we project. Some people, and I have many of them, I'm continuing to do interviews. I've done well over 400 of them and am going on. Some people who have already been on a spiritual path don't even need an experience. They already know, and therefore, even if they've had a cardiac arrest, they're not going to get one. And some people may just need a little confirmation, may just need to know that, let's say, their husband who is deceased will be there for them, and that may be all they will get. Some people who have tried to commit suicide need to know that they are loved and that they're forgiven for everything, as we all are. None of us, I better not speak for us. I, as probably most of us, have certainly made poor decisions in our lifetime, sometimes said something hateful that we would give anything in the world to take back. None of us can be perfect. And it may just be that in a near-death event, a person may need to feel that forgiveness. Some may need to be shown that life review and made to understand that we better take responsibility. So just one more thing. It isn't that if someone has tried to commit suicide for whatever reason that they are necessarily going to have an experience, let alone a frightening one. We know of many, 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 many that have wonderful, the most profound experiences who have tried to abort their own life. But what's really wonderful is that, and this was written also by Bruce Grayson, of course, fabulous researcher, that the amazing thing is you would have thought that if it's such a blissful experience that you're given, that you might really try it again straight away, wanting to remain on the other side. No. Nearly everyone realizes that life is so precious that we do not have the right, it is not an option, to stop our own or anyone else's. Oh, wait, there was one over here.
And there's John McDonough, I'm a psychologist. And I want to thank Dr. Romer. I really enjoyed your talk. And since the subject of suicide has come up, and I will kind of confirm what you're saying, I'm not really into the research angle of this, but one of my patients who had attempted suicide before she saw me in therapy described... she wasn't one of my casualties. She described a scene where she came to a beautiful green meadow, and there was, after an overdose of medication, and there was a river or stream down the middle of this, and on the far side of the stream she saw Jesus, and he didn't say any words to her, he just made the motion to go back, and she came back, and she was very glad she did, because she had two more children that she never would have had, and so forth. But staying on the topic of suicide, that's one of the areas that really kind of piqued my interest quite a number of years ago, and I've been kind of talking to my clients who are thinking about suicide about the near-death experience, and in recent years what I've come to do is to lend them a copy of Raymond Moody's tape, Life After Life, and a number of people have said that tape saved their lives, really. And unfortunately, the tape is now out of print. So part of the reason I came here was to sort of touch base with people who might be able to see if we could get that tape back in print, because it really has tremendous potential as a suicide prevention technique.
Our president is saying
yes. Yes. Okay. Thank you very much.
Really, but that's always
that
nice to hear.
That is actually the truth.
I want to take a minute... I want to thank Barbara, because I think it's such an important issue, not only that she wrote this book and that she's doing everything that she's doing, but she's also setting a model for medical care that we desperately need in terms of loving and caring. And I want to thank her for that and hope that we can, as she goes out and talks among her peers, that she will be able to lessen the fear of other people who have it in them. They just think they can't do it. And we have to change the medical model. And Barbara and myself and Debbie and many other medical people who have been talking to people for years about this, I think it's wonderful, because she's made a big impact on that. And I'd fly to Florida to see her if she'd just sit down and talk to me.
Oh,
so,
absolutely.
That's what we're all looking for in a physician, and I want to thank her for that.
Thank you, Dolly. But it's not easy with the physicians, and I've said this before, and I'm not making this up. To this minute in time, there are physicians who will not get in the elevator with me at Holy Cross. Even going up, but yeah, they think I am going down. It's absolutely, it's unbelievable. Yeah, come on up.
Keep stalling Ed here. I just wanted to address a comment about the suicide prevention, which is, I have some friends who at times are contemplating suicide, and I've been giving them Sandra Rogers. What? Oh, you can't hear me. it's kind of bad on my back here like this. I give them Sandra Rogers book, Lessons from the Light, which we have for sale up here, because her NDE was as a result of suicide. And she also has a number of tapes that she's done at the IANS conferences in the past, which are excellent, in my opinion, suicide prevention kinds of things. And those are in print and available from us. So,
Ed, come on out.
My name is Edward Salisbury. And Barbara, the more I know you, the more I love you. I am a survivor who went through 7 major surgeries following an auto wreck. And this presentation has put a whole new perspective on, you know, my research has been as a patient. And I'm encouraging everyone who's a caregiver to think about changes we can make. I've always thought, you know, so many times I'm riding in the gurney going from my bed to the surgery saying, why don't they put some pictures up there? Words of encouragement. Yeah. Have a good trip. And I'm finding that I got a new perspective on, you know, less than positive NDEs. I'd had a near-death experience. And what was not positive was my experience of my wife's drowning when I could not bring her back up to the surface. And as I came up for air, having chosen not to stay with her under the water, I can remember cursing God and setting the tone of my subsequent agonies and of finding salvation through this association and the sharing that we give each other, that there is a spirit that loves us, and the only thing that prevents that from being a delight is us. And so I'm just encouraging everyone, open our hearts. And thank you, teacher.
Thank you, sir. A personal opinion, but I have come to believe that, I've come to know that we probably do choose into whose uterus we come, and for what purpose, and to accomplish what, even if we forget it straight away when we're in the physical. I think there are very definite reasons why my little munchkin, my little boy, came in as profoundly handicapped as he did. Thank God he came to me, because I would be a totally different person if it wasn't for him. And so I believe, Ed, that your wife on a soul level knew that she would not be sticking around for more years, and maybe that was part of her. That is what she chose, and in some way related to the lesson, and truly. Sir, come up.
Sir, that's the nicest thing anybody's called me all day. Barbara, you described a situation where the man hit his ear against the door, and he said, and it was explained to him that this area was a place where God, where his love did not go. That really challenges my perception of what God is and where God is able and is not able to go. Have you had other people describe it like that, and have you a sense of God not going in certain places?
Different take on it. Yes, I have had. I have several stories in the book. I didn't say that to push the book. This isn't about economics and money. but I have a lot that I couldn't put in the book, and also because I'm continuing to interview people, I have a lot that I didn't even know about when I did that book. But my take on it was very different. It wasn't that a higher being, the ultimate energy, creator, God, the Alpha and the Omega, whatever you like to call that energy force, because I want to be politically correct, so whatever makes you happy makes me happy. My impression is that that energy can be everywhere and anywhere at the same time, but it is our decision what we are willing to accept. I believe it's those choices of ours. And I believe that if there is an area that we may create because we are not open to acknowledging and accepting that unconditional love, then that's up to us. That wasn't a proper sentence, but you know what I mean. I think what a entity thinks in spirit form immediately manifests. And if one is not willing to be open and makes those bad choices, that may be that they will not go into the light until they have help in showing them that they don't have to be there, wherever there is. I have to tell you that I did an interview, I'll say this really, quick. A gentleman called me 3 weeks after that four-hour radio show, so had the number, held it all that time, thought about it, finally called me, and said that he has never told anyone any of this and knows that I will get his information out in just exactly his words. See the point? We're not supposed to be paraphrasing. And what unbelievable information this gentleman has. Man, is he going to be a big part of this second book, because information about what's going to be coming, apocalyptic, that's not his word, believe me, and I hate the word. I guess it's the media's word. Apocalyptic messages and earth changes and stuff like that. Whereas all of the people, a good six or seven of them, who have said that they have received astounding information on the other side, either will say, A, but I can't tell anyone because I don't want everyone to be afraid. Or B, I know that was a nasty way of saying it. Or B, I was told I'm not supposed to give that information. It's like dangle this carrot and then don't help your fellow spiritual beings. Whereas this doll from Texas says, use my name, don't use my name, say you said it, I don't care what you said it, but it has to be the way I'm saying it, these words, and you have to get this information out there. I don't care how you do it, but you must. Man, what a difference. Yes. And he addressed this and many other things just exactly, that we do get what we project that our belief system is. Yeah.
This concludes tape number F1, Update, Less Than Positive Near-Death Experiences with Dr. Barbara Romer. If you're interested in purchasing another copy of this tape or others in the series, please contact Perpetual Motion Unlimited. at 10332 Left Hand Canyon Drive, Jamestown, Colorado, 80455. You may phone at 303-444-3158 or fax at 303-444-7077.